Hey, everybody, from the tech desk and where else? Brussels, Belgium. It's Clark. It's time for episode number 325 of The Best Kept Secret in Podcasting. It's the World's Technology Podcast. Now, The World, for those of you who don't know, is a one-hour international news program co-produced by the BBC World Service in London, Public Radio International, and WGBH Radio in Boston. Find out more about our great show and all of our other podcasts at theworld.org. All right. Now, about a year ago, a little over a year ago, I told you about this really interesting global phenomenon called Pechakcha. That's spelled P-E-C-H-A, new word, K-U-C-H-A, pronounced in the Japanese style, Pechakcha, which is Japanese, I've been told, for chit-chat. Now, this idea, as we told you at the time, was started by two architects working in Tokyo, Mark Dytham and Astrid Klein, both loyal listeners to the World's Technology Podcast, I must say. And they came up with this idea that they wanted to host regular meetings where architects and designers and other creative people could present their ideas. Kind of little mini brainstorming sessions, but they didn't want anybody to go on for too long, so they set a time limit. You got essentially 20 slides, and you got 20 seconds per slide. So you got about 6 minutes and 40 seconds to tell everybody about your work, your big idea, whatever you want to talk about. Well, and then the Haiti earthquake happened, and they decided to do a global day for Haiti to raise money. They raised about $80,000. It was enough to build a school in Haiti. And as I probably told you at the time, Pechakcha started about 2003. There are now more than 400 cities that host regular Pechakcha nights. It's pretty incredible how this has spread. Of course, I wondered what's going on in the aftermath of the earthquake and tsunami in Japan. So I got on Skype with Mark Dytham and found out that they are, in fact, organizing a very similar day for Japan. It's going to be a series of Pechakcha events across the globe to raise money and ideas more than anything for Japan. So I wanted to run this update interview. I'm doing a piece for the show today, but you know the great thing about the podcast is I can give you something different. And this is the full interview with Mark, who starts out just by talking about how tough the last month has been living in Tokyo.
Yeah, it's been a very surreal 4 weeks, and it's the anniversary of the quake today, and we've had another, you know, there's been another 7.1, 6.4, and a 6.1 just now, yeah. So we only get our nerves rattled in Tokyo, but it's pretty tough up in northeast Japan. But that you knew, we were giving a presentation. There were 40 folks in front of us, and Astrid and I was just like, "We've got to get out of here." You know, it was just that, you know, you knew something was kind of. It was just a different quake, and it went for 3 minutes, and that was really strange. And we were in the middle of Tokyo. Ran out into the middle of the road, stopped the traffic, and it kind of felt like Toontown. You weren't sure where was the level point. The buildings were kind of dancing around. They really were dancing. Mm. But amazingly, nothing broke. There were no broken windows, very little damage. And everybody went around there sort of, you know, we sort of walked back to the office. And just before we got to the office, I was beginning to see, stopped at a coffee shop. And suddenly you could see these boats being dragged down this river, you know. But the thing was that the phones were down, and I've got a daughter at school, 5 and a half, son at home with the help. I can't get in touch with my wife because there was just no way we could get in touch with people. So I thought, well, we'll run to our emergency plan, which is I go home and check my son's okay, and Natasha, my wife, would go and pick up my daughter. Is the plan, yeah. But having no phones was this really, really scary moment, you know. And it took me 3.5 hours, 4 hours to get the whole family back together again. You know,
you're running the Pechakcha nights. I mean, when does the idea hit you that you would like to try to do something for Japan? Then
it'd been a really surreal week, I think, and then people were. The biggest problem we had was mailing. I had about 2,500 mails from people asking if we're okay, and it sounds really, really terrible. It was kind of difficult to mail people. And I'm sorry if we didn't mail. You know, we got tweets, we got Skypes, we got Facebooks, we got mails, and it was kind of, you know, it was amazing, but it was also incredibly difficult to balance that while we're looking at the TV on Saturday morning, seeing one of the reactors go. And shall we leave Tokyo? Shall we stay? I've got an office of 20 staff. It's kind of all these really weird things going through your mind. And then it, And then there was people saying, well, we should do a global event for Japan. And I'm like, well, that's, yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm really behind that. But we should do it for you, sort of thing. It's like, well, that's okay, but I've got the address book type thing. And, you know, we didn't feel like we'd been that badly hit in Tokyo. And it's very difficult at this point to get really involved with the sort of the recovery point and what's going on right now. I mean, there were, you know, there's 120,000 troops there. The systems go into play, and they really did go into play that night. The helicopters, the big Chinooks were flying over Tokyo, and it just felt like they were doing something, you know, and that was pretty amazing. So about a week later, we thought we should do something. And again, the thing is, do you do it quickly or do you wait and do you plan it? But I think we felt with Haiti, you have to take the moment, the momentum of the point. And you know, we've got Easter, we've got the royal wedding, we've got another opening in one of our projects. So it's like, well, let's do it on the 16th. That's it. Let's go for it. So we started about 2 weeks ago, and the site went up today, and we have about 120 cities running events on Saturday the 16th.
And you're trying to do that same thing again, where you're kind of rolling it across the globe?
Yeah, but it's much, we've organized, I actually have a team of folks now as opposed to me and a MacBook Air, you know. it's kind of different this time around. So we learned a lot of things doing it last time. So this time, all of the cities will be streaming out on Ustream. So you'll be able to go to the website, you'll be able to see which cities are live and which cities are streaming. And we won't be trying to mix those together or curate them in any kind of way. And we already have enough streams to make it a continuous 24-hour event if everybody can stream successfully. You know, we're doing an event in amazingly, the people in Sendai are having a Pachacha night there. Amazingly, you know, they had no electricity again last night. You know, so they mailed us this morning saying, we'll have an event if we have electricity. You know, we have people in Nagano too presenting. So it's going to be a little bit more relaxed than last time. And I'm trying to take the pressure off of myself and Astrid. We don't have to be the compares for it.
Right.
So it should be fairly automatic.
But the idea is the same, is that the presenters will, I mean, you're hoping to raise some money, but really to sort of generate some ideas here about.
Yeah, it's a couple of things, Clark. I think the first is that we've called this Inspire Japan, and this is very different to Haiti, where it was about reconstruction. Because, you know, Japan can rebuild, the big housing makers make 1,000 houses a week. And there was a thing it was in one of the newspapers where one of the expressways was rebuilt in 4 days. There isn't an issue about rebuilding in Japan. But there is this problem that, you know, 400 kilometers of coastline have been wiped away. And, you know, villages have just gone. And you know, are people going to want to rebuild? It's about inspiring the nation. And our thought was that so many designers around the world have been inspired by Japan, inspired by Katsura Villa. They've been inspired by Shoji Screens, Izumiaki, Comme des Garçons, Muji. You know, the list is endless, really. And I think it's really their chance to sort of inspire Japan now and sort of turn the table. And that's the most important thing that we're trying to get across. If you're a designer, you've been inspired by Japan, come to the website and donate $20, you know. And it goes to an amazing cause, which is Architecture for Humanity. They've been a great partner for our Haiti event, and they did exactly what they said they would do and build a school. And $80,000, every penny has gone to building a school, which has just started on site last week. And Cameron's already, we're already in conversations with lots of the existing groups, the architectural groups here. So I'm kind of helping act, Astrid and I are helping act as a go-between the existing the architectural networks here, and we the thought is with the money we raise is to sort of improve the type of architecture that's being rebuilt. We're not just putting in loads and loads of the same houses. We're trying to think of, you know, a sort of a creative solution, and this will be a very long term project, like in Haiti too. So we're kind of the last responders, as Cameron would say, not the first responders. But we're trying to take, you know, the energy of the moment, and trying to, you know, trying to do something right now.
We should point out that, I mean, you and Astrid went there because you were inspired by Japan as well, right?
Exactly. And it's really our home. And that was the most difficult thing after the quake. A lot of foreigners sort of left, or, you know, quite rightly, when we don't have, you know, you have to make your own decisions. But, you know, this is really our home, you know. It's not, we have nowhere else to go, in effect, a fat family here. Right. And so it was kind of trying to deal with that, you know. So, you know, Japan has given us a huge, huge amount, and it really is our turn to give Japan something back, you know.
And it is a striking moment for Japan as well. I mean, because the economic situation has been rough over the past decade, even a little bit longer, and now there's been this huge event. I mean, is it in some ways cathartic, do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we try and look on sort of the bright side and think that this might be the moment that, you know, Japan changes for the better. In fact, you know, lots of firms not having overtime, people have to leave the office at 5 o'clock. So guys have to, you know, I have to work between 9 and 5, and then they go home and see their kids, you know. And I think the other amazing thing is that you'll see, you know, online or wherever, and one of the things we're trying to show during the event on Saturday is that there are so many charities and amazing things which are going on in Japan, which are being started by creative firms. You know, there's people designing skateboards and T-shirts and posters and all sorts of amazing things. And there's, you know, there's a huge creative sort of energy in Japan right now, trying to help. And, you know, it's kind of sad looking at the banks and the big firms. There doesn't seem to be anything. They're saying, you know, just send money to the Red Cross. But within the creative firms and the creative industries, there's a, you know, an amazing passion. And that's what we hope to highlight on Saturday.
So you'll have one in Tokyo. What kinds of presentations are going to be on offer?
We have all sorts. we hopefully have somebody who's been going to all the bathhouses up in all of the sentos, all of the bathhouses in northern Japan, and trying to get them restarted. He's going to be speaking. We have Ian Lynham and Jon Snow talking about all the creative events that are going on. We have we're holding the event on the 52nd floor of Roppongi Hills, one of the highest, tallest buildings in Tokyo. And very kindly, the Mori Corporation have allowed us to have the space. It's fantastic space, and that really does show our commitment to our faith in Tokyo, our faith in the architecture in Japan. And you know, we're overlooking the whole of the city, and it's amazing. It's an amazing space. So we're going to have some engineers talking about how they engineered the building. And we're going to kind of have a bit of fun. I think that, you know, it's been a very tough month for Japan. And we're going to be bringing a smile to lots of faces, but also taking this very, very seriously. And trying to, again, like we did for Haiti, many of the presentations, there are 80 or 90 presentations online. And they've been viewed, you know, 10 or 15,000 times, you know, solutions to the problems at hand. Right. So we hope we generate a lot of smiles, but also a lot of interesting thoughts that we can record in the projector format on the site.
And of course, things will be kicking off in Christchurch. It's pretty amazing, given what they've been through, that they raised their hand and volunteered to kick things off.
Yeah, I mean, it was really difficult because we were about to start, like, you know, a Pachacha Global event for Christchurch or run an event. And we were talking to Vanessa there in Christchurch. I was just there before the quake, in fact, you know. And then all of a sudden it happens on our doorstep. I'm like, what do we do? Do we call it, you know, Pachacha for Earthquake Relief? Or so I've decided we call it, you know, Inspire Japan. But if you can kick it off in Christchurch, Vanessa, that would be fantastic. So the first presentation will be from Christchurch, which I think is amazing, their sort of bravery and courage there. Right. And obviously all the funds raised in New Zealand will go to their earthquake fund. So it's amazing. We're also going to be talking to our team in Concepcion in Chile. Mm-hmm. We're also going to get a live report from the school site in Haiti. And as I say, we'll be chatting to Sendai and also Nagano. So we have a pretty amazing family.
Well, Mark, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. Thanks very much indeed.
Mark Dytham there in Tokyo, who along with his architectural partner, Astrid Klein, are the creators of Pachacha. Now, if you want to find out more about all of Saturday's events, the best place to go is to theworld.org/technology, where I'll put a very prominent link that you can follow to find the Inspire Japan page. All right. Now, you may have heard this week that it was a pretty special anniversary. 50 years ago, Yuri Gagarin, Soviet cosmonaut, became the first person in space, first person to orbit the Earth. Here's how I covered it on the show.
50 years ago today, Soviet cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin became the first human in space. He managed to complete one orbit of the Earth aboard the Vostok 1 spacecraft. Gagarin returned to Earth a hero, and not just in the Soviet Union. Here's the world's Clark Boyd.
Yuri Gagarin's jaunt into space captured the world's imagination in 1961. Here's how the BBC reported the story.
Here is the news. All Moscow is waiting to give a hero's welcome to the world's first spaceman, Major Gagarin of the Soviet Air Force. Here's a Moscow recording of his voice as he went through space.
For the Soviets, it was a time of celebration. Sergei Khrushchev is son of then-Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev.
For him, it was one more proof that we are doing right, and of course that we show outside world that we can achieve all the things.
For the Soviets, Gagarin was PR gold. The cosmonaut wasn't just honored in the Soviet Union. After his historic journey into space, he went on a kind of world tour. This BBC newsreel captures his welcome in Manchester, England.
The Amalgamated Union of Foundry Workers made him number one honorary member and gave him a gold medal.
But, says Sergei Khrushchev, not everyone was happy.
In any race, if you are first, you're just celebrating. If you are second, then you are just have very sad days.
We are behind, but we are working hard, and we are going to increase our effort.
For President Kennedy and many in the U.S. at the time, Gagarin's flight was the latest in an alarming string of Soviet accomplishments. Kathleen Lewis is a curator at the National Air and Space Museum.
The Soviet Union had launched the first artificial satellite. They had launched the first animal into space, Laika the dog. They were the first country to actually target the moon and have an impact on the moon. And now here they're launching the first human into space.
By the end of the decade, the U.S. Apollo program would put the first humans on the moon. Gagarin would not live to see that. He died in 1968 during a training accident. These days, with the Cold War far behind, NASA astronaut Michael Foale pays tribute to Gagarin.
The idea of working together in space at that time was inconceivable. Today, we can all be extraordinarily proud of the people that have come before us in transitioning from this very, very opponent-based attempt to conquer space to one of partnership.
One place that's certainly true is aboard the International Space Station. With the space shuttle nearing retirement, Russia's Soyuz rockets are the only way to get there and back. Last night, American astronaut Catherine Coleman, who is on board the space station, teamed up with Jethro Tull's Ian Anderson for a flute duet in Gagarin's honor. For the world, this is Clark Boyd.
You can see a video of the Earth-Space duet at theworld.org.
Now, of course, I had to keep that piece pretty short. There was a lot of good stuff that I couldn't include. One of the things that I couldn't include that I can give you here on the podcast is this interview with Jeffrey Hoffman, who is a 5-time space shuttle veteran. He's now a professor of the practice of astronautics at MIT. And here's his interview with the BBC.
Nobody really knew what it was going to be like. I mean, it's amazing in retrospect, but you look back at some of the medical papers that were written 50 years ago, and people were questioning whether humans could even breathe in weightlessness and swallow and digest, and I mean, all the things which we take for granted now. But, you know, could human beings go into space and survive? And of course, Yuri was the first.
And your own first experience in space. Describe what does happen to the human body. What happened to your body when you went through that?
Well, you're shaking around. I mean, I've heard a shuttle launch described as the equivalent of riding down a set of railroad tracks on an old pickup truck with no suspension. It's just really a lot of vibration for the first couple of minutes when the solid rocket boosters are firing. It's just shaking and tremendously noisy. After 2 minutes, the booster rockets fall off, and at that point, things get rather quiet because the liquid fuel engines on the shuttle, which are burning hydrogen and oxygen, are quite smooth. course, it's a kind of a neat view out the window, because after just a little more than a minute or so, the sky has already turned completely black. But at that point, what you're really waiting for is what we call MECO, main engine cutoff, which is just a wonderful feeling when, you know, after this incredible experience that you've just gone through, all of a sudden it gets very quiet and you can sort of feel yourself floating up out of your seat against your straps. All of the internal organs in your body are now rearranging themselves, and there's a big rush of fluid up to your head because gravity is no longer pulling it down. It feels a little bit like hanging upside down. But the human body is remarkably resilient. And normally after about 3 days or so, pretty much everybody has accommodated and is just having a ball up there, you know, floating around. And it's like being Superman.
And space exploration does seem to have stalled now. I'm surprised that there isn't a moon base, because from there, it seems to me, somebody who grew up in the exciting space age, that you could do almost anything. You could go up there, you could experiment with the effect on the human body, you could launch missions to further planets and so on. That hasn't happened. Why not?
Well, it is frustrating. I think one of the things is, when we look at Project Apollo, it was NASA's finest moment, but in a sense it's been a bit of a curse as well, because we have to realize Apollo was a very unique time in history. It was the Cold War. I mean, we were not spending $20 billion back in, you know, 1960s money, which was a lot more in today's equivalent. We weren't spending that just to do science or even to do exploration. I mean, President Kennedy wanted to do something which would beat the Russians. And, of course, it turned into this marvelous adventure, which I think has stimulated people all over the world. It was a great moment for the human spirit, but it was not sustainable, nor was it designed to be. I think for years, many people, certainly at NASA, I've seen this firsthand, have had the idea that, you know, all we have to do is wait for another president to come around and tell us to do it all over again. But that's not going to happen. We have to learn, if we're going to go beyond the Earth, and I hope we do, and people finally seem to be starting to get around to realizing that we've got to do it on a much more constrained budget. In the States, we are looking at ways of involving the private sector in access to space, which will save NASA money. We've got to do it in a different way. Project Apollo was an incredible adventure, but it's not going to be repeated.
Will it be a private adventurer, like the early Everest expeditions, for example, privately funded by explorers? Is that going to be the first Mars mission?
It's hard to say. I mean, right now, the cost of a Mars mission is so literally astronomical that I think it's even out of line for private investment. But, you know, we would have said the same thing about any sort of access to space. And yet we now have private companies which are developing their own rockets. They will hopefully within a few years be providing access to low Earth orbit. And for instance, Elon Musk of SpaceX just announced that they are developing a heavy lift vehicle, privately financed, that will be the second most powerful vehicle ever developed except for the Saturn V. And that's the sort of thing that actually might be a game-changing kind of development. If NASA can actually purchase access to space from the private sector at the marginal cost of providing this, which of course assumes that the private sector can sell it to other people than NASA, which they assume they can, then that leaves NASA with a lot more money for exploration, which is what I'd really like to see the agency doing.
And let me finish with the accountant's question, if you like. Why not just do it with machines? Why does humankind, why do men and women have to go into space?
Well, you can talk a lot about who can accomplish what kind of science, but I think it goes deeper than that. When somebody finds out that I'm an astronaut, what's the first question they ask me? It's, what's it like in space? That's what the human spirit is interested in. That is at the very core of exploration. I love robots in space. I mean, you know, I'm never going to get to the surface of Mars. Our rovers are doing incredible things. But I'd love a chance to ask somebody, what's it like to be on Mars? What's it like as a human being to be on Mars? Because That's something you can't ask a robot. They take great pictures, they measure the cosmic ray composition and the chemistry and all of that, but they don't feel things, they don't experience things like we do, and they can't share human experience. So for me, that's part of exploration.
Okay, veteran shuttle astronaut Jeffrey Hoffman there. Now, to see it from the other side is interesting as well. This is an interview that the BBC did with Roald Sagdeyev, who is a Soviet and Russian expert in plasma physics and former director of the Space Research Institute at the USSR Academy of Sciences. Here's how he remembers Gagarin's launch.
Actually, it was completely out of blue. It was a surprise to me. I was at that time with my first visit to the United States as a young scientist. And in Atel in New York, you know, switching on TV, I had discovered the whole story.
Did you have to, as a Russian, keep quiet about this seeming victory over your Cold War enemy, being the, you know, given that you were in the States?
I actually witnessed how American TV and American mass media was so excited during a few days, all the stories about this flight.
So in a way, you're saying the opposite from what we often hear, that actually it brought people together for a greater adventure, if you like.
Absolutely. And to some degree, it was expected that Russians would do something else beyond Sputnik.
When you look back at this time, what do you think of the importance of it, the significance of it? I mean, obviously, it changed space travel for good.
I think, first of all, it was very important for Russians, for Soviets themselves. The country was completely devastated at the end of World War II, and we were taken back with everything, with everyday life, industry, science, and suddenly these successes, Sputnik, Gagarin, you know, feeling of pride immediately came to everyone. And I guess Americans took it as a challenge for them.
And you now, you've been one of the creators, the initiators, the International Space Station. Do you feel that now it's all very different, that it's all very pally and chummy and people are friends and that rivalry has gone, or is it still there?
You know, I would say that if you compare Gagarin's first flight with what modern-day astronauts are doing on space station, he was just as a passenger doing nothing. He was not given any freedom to make decisions or to press any buttons. Today's astronauts are doing a lot of sophisticated jobs, repair the station when it's needed. They go outside for more sophisticated jobs and so on.
And what about manned missions now? I mean, there's talk of sending a manned mission to Mars. Do you think that the similar sort of excitement is coming back into space travel that existed in the 50s and 60s?
I'm afraid it is not the case. I think now space program, especially man-made program, is in a state of saturation. I would not expect very soon to see flights sending men to even to the moon.
So at the end of manned missions, you think, for the foreseeable future, we're going to see no major breakthrough as we saw when Yuri Gagarin went up into space?
I think we have to find some new key to the whole issue. We have to reinvigorate it. Otherwise, most people would say, look what robotic spacecrafts are doing with the Hubble telescope, Fermi high-energy telescope, robotic missions flying over the whole solar system, and a lot of applied work in like telecommunication and so on.
Roald Sagdeyev there, remembering the launch into space of Yuri Gagarin 50 years ago this week. Okay, here's how we're going to end Tech Podcast 325, the Oramix machine, one of the most significant devices in the history of electronic music. Wow, it's going to go on display at the Science Museum in London for the first time this summer. Now, this is the creation of Daphne Oram, the first director of the BBC's Radiophonic Workshop and a central figure in the evolution of electronic music. Now, Miss Oram died in 2003, and she had created a device which enabled musicians to,
quote-unquote, draw sounds. Now, this was built in the 60s, and the real significance here was that it not only made it made possible not only the creation of synthetic sounds, but also their arrangement. Here's the BBC's Chris Valance to tell us more.
In a curator's career, you come across a very small number of very wonderful things that you feel you must add to the museum's collections. And this is just one of those half dozen objects in a career.
In a storage facility in West London, Tim Boone, chief curator of the Science Museum, leads us to a significant object in the history of electronic music.
This is the only Oramix machine ever made. It's in four bits, what we've got here. That is, if you like, the input device. That's
Daphne Oram died in 2003. Over four decades earlier, this electronic music pioneer and founder of the BBC Radiophonic Workshop had started work on a revolutionary device that would allow sounds and compositions to be drawn. In her own words, she explains the principle.
Oramix graphic sound, produced not by electronic generators nor by musical instruments, but by drawing graphs and feeding these graphs into computer-type equipment.
Dr. Mick Grierson of Goldsmiths College is director of the Daphne Oram collection.
It represents the first time in England that someone had built a device that was capable of synthesis and also composition at the same time. Essentially, you'd stand in front of the machine and there would be a series of 35mm film strips, exactly the same strips that you'd normally get if you were projecting a film in a cinema. And this allows you to mark out on the film strips particular notes that you want to play and also say how loud you want those notes to play.
These sounds you're hearing in the background now were all made by the graphs, yet they sound rather like strange new musical instruments.
I'm Sarah Anglis, and I'm an engineer and electronic musician, and I'm standing in front of the Oramix machine.
For contemporary musicians, Daphne's work is an inspiration.
We've spent centuries playing instruments that are very physical, and we've suddenly retreated into this virtual world. And I think Daphne's instrument is wonderful because it's almost like a missing link. It's very sort of physical, and yet at the same time I look at it and there's a really strong family resemblance to the sort of software that people like me use every day. And so it sort of seems to have the best of both worlds.
For all its prescience, the machine has a homemade feel. Much of the original machine was the work of engineer Graham Wrench.
Working with Daphne could be both challenging but also quite inspirational. We would have very strong debates into sometimes the early hours of the morning as to what we were trying to do and how far could we take it on our limited resources. I was entering into uncharted waters that I found absolutely fascinating.
The machine will go on public display for the first time this summer, although it is too fragile to play again. It is fitting recognition, according to Tim Boone.
There are people who make a significant difference to the field they work in, and Daphne Oram is just one of those crucial figures, the small handful of people who, in the second half of the 20th century, more or less invented electronic music, and she is one of those people.
The range of sound available is enormous. I'm just beginning the exploration of this vast new continent of music.
The BBC's Chris Valance, Ending Tech Podcast 325 there. Remember, you can follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. We're World's Tech Pod at both places. Also, be sure to come on over to theworld.org, where you can find the technology podcast page and get the show notes, links, pictures, videos if we have them, all sorts of things to enhance your podcast listening experience. You can also email me, Clark, clark.boyd@bbc.co.uk. All right, I'm on vacation next week, so we'll catch up with you in a couple of weeks. Bye-bye.
Support for the World's Technology Podcast comes from the National Science Foundation, where discoveries begin, nsf.gov, and from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org.